This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents
Cold Sassy Tree by Olivan Burns. Dedication to Andy, my beloved, to Becky and John, our grown children, and to my father, who was 14 in 1906. Chapter 1. 3 weeks after Granny Blakesley died, Grandpa came to our house for his early morning snort of whiskey, as usual, and said to me, "Will Tweedy, go find your mama, then run up to your Aunt Loma's and tell her I say get on down here. I got something to say, and I ain't a-going to say it but once." "Yes, sir." "Make haste, son. I got to get on to the store." Mama made me wait till she pinned the black mourning band for Granny on my shirt sleeve. Then I was off. Any time Grandpa had something to say, it was something you couldn't wait to hear. That was 8 years ago on a Thursday morning, when Grandpa Blakesley was 59 and I was 14. The date was July 5th, 1906. I know because Grandpa put it down in the family Bible, and also Toddy Hughes wrote up for the Atlanta paper what happened to me on the train trestle that day, and I still have the clipping. Besides that, I remember it was right after our July the 4th celebration, the first one held in Cold Sassy, Georgia, since the war between the states. July 5, 1906 was 3 months after the big earthquake in San Francisco, and about 2 months after a stranger drove through Cold Sassy in a Pope Waverly electric automobile that got stalled trying to cross the railroad tracks. I pushed it up the incline, and the man let me ride as far as the Athens Highway. July 5, 1906 was a year after my great-grandmother on the Tweedy side died for the second and last time out in Banks County. It was 6 months after my best friend Bluford Jackson got firecrackers for Christmas and burned his hand on one and died of lockjaw 10 days later. And like I said, it was only 3 weeks after Granny Blakesley went to the grave. During those 3 weeks, Grandpa Blakesley had sort of drawn back inside his own skin, acted like I didn't mean any more to him than a stick of stove would. On the morning of July 5th, he stalked through the house and into our company room without even speaking to me. Granny never would let him keep his corn whiskey at home. He kept it in the company room at our house, which was between the depot and downtown, and came by for a snort every morning on his way to work. I and my little red-headed sister, Mary Toy, always followed him down the hall, and he usually gave us each a stick of penny candy before shutting the company room door in our faces. While our spit swam over horehound or peppermint, we'd hear the floorboards creak in the closet, then a silence, then a big "ruff," and a big satisfied "ah." He would come out smiling, ready for the day, and pat Mary Toy's head as he went past her. But this particular morning was different. For one thing, Mary Toy had gone home with Cuddin Temp the day before, and Grandpa, instead of coming out feeling good, looked like somebody itching for a fight. That's when he said, "Will Tweedy," he always called me both names except when he called me son, said, "Will Tweedy, go find your mama, then run up to your Aunt Loma's and tell her I said, get on down here." Lots of people in Cold Sassy had a telephone, including us. Grandpa didn't. He had one at the store so he could phone orders to the wholesale house in Athens, but he was too stingy to pay for one at home. Aunt Loma didn't have a phone either. She and Uncle Camp were too poor. That's why I had to go tell her. I ran all the way, my brown and white bird dog T.R. bounding ahead. As usual, when we got to Aunt Loma's, the dog plopped down on the dirt sidewalk in front of her house to wait. He couldn't go up in the dern yard because of the dern cats, of which there were 18 or 20 at least. They would scratch his eyes out if he went any closer. I found Aunt Loma sitting at the kitchen table, her long curly red hair still loose and tousled, the dirty breakfast dishes pushed back to clear a space. With one cat in her lap and another licking an oatmeal bowl on the table, she sat drinking coffee and reading a book of theater plays. Mama never knew how often Aunt Loma put pleasure before duty like that. Mama liked to stay in front of her work, but then Loma was young, just 20, and slovenly. When I told her what Grandpa said, she slammed her book down so hard the cat leaped off the table. "Why don't you just tell him I'm busy?" But even as she spoke, she stood up, gulped some coffee, set down the cup still half full, and rushed upstairs to change into a black dress on account of her mother having just died and all. When she came down, carrying fat, sleepy Campbell Jr., her mass of red hair was combed, pinned up, and draped with what she called my genteel black veil. Campbell Jr. pulled at the veil all the way to our house, and Aunt Loma fussed all the way. When we got there, she handed the baby over to our cook, Queenie, and hurried in where Grandpa was pacing the front hall, his high-top black shoes squeaking as he walked. I couldn't help noticing how in only 3 weeks as a widower he already looked like one. His dark bushy hair and long gray beard were tangled. The heavy droopy mustache had some dried food stuck on it. His black hat, pants, and vest were dusty, and the homemade white shirt rusty with tobacco juice. Granny always prided herself on keeping his wild hair and beard trimmed, his shirts clean, his pants brushed and nice. Now that she was gone, he couldn't do for himself very well, having only the one hand, but he wouldn't let Mama or Aunt Loma do for him. "Morning, Pa," Aunt Loma grumped. "Is that y'all, Will?" Mama called from the dining room, where she was closing windows and pulling down shades to keep out the morning sun. We waited in the front hall till she hurried in, her hair still in a thick plait down one side of her neck. I always thought she looked pretty with it like that, almost like a young girl. Mama was a plain person like Granny, and didn't dress fancy the way Aunt Loma did every time she stuck her nose out of the house. Even at home, Aunt Loma was fancy. She wouldn't have been caught dead in an apron made out of a flour sack, whereas Mama had one that still read, "Try Skylock Self-Rising Flour," right across the chest. The words hadn't washed out yet, which I was sure Aunt Loma noticed as she said crossly, "Morning, sister." Taking off the apron as if we had real company, Mama said to me, "Son, you go gather the eggs here. With Mary Torgon, you got to gather the eggs." "Yes'm." My feet dragged me toward the back hall.
"Let them eggs wait, Mary Willis," Grandpa ordered. "I want Will Tweedy to hear what I come to say. He'll know soon enough anyways."
Then he stomped toward the open front door and put his hand on the knob as if all he planned to say was goodbye, or maybe more like he was fixing to put a match to a string of firecrackers and then run before they went off. My mother asked nervous like, "You want us all to go sit in the parlor, sir?" He shook his head.
"Nah, Mary Willis, it won't take long enough to sit down for."
He took off his black hat and laid it on the table, pulled at his mustache, scratched through the white streak in his beard, and turned those deep blue eyes on Mama and Aunt Loma, his grown children, standing together puzzled and uneasy. When he began his announcement, you could tell he had practiced it.
"Now, daughters, you know I was true to your mother. Miss Mattie Lou was a fine wife, a good cook, a real good woman, beloved by all in this here town and by me, as y'all know."
Hearing Grandpa go on about Granny made my throat ache. Mama and Aunt Loma went to sobbing out loud, their arms around each other.
"Now quit your blubbering, Mary Willis. Hush up, Loma. I ain't finished."
Then his voice softened.
"Since your mama's passing, I've been a-studying on our life together. 36 years we had, and they was good years. I want y'all to know I ain't never going to forget her."
"Course you won't, won't, Pa," said my mother, sobbing.
"But she's gone, just like this here hand of mine."
He held up his left arm, the shirt sleeve knotted as usual just below the elbow. Grandpa's blue eyes were suddenly glassy with unspilled tears. He struggled to get a hold of himself, then went on.
"Like I said, she's gone now. So I've been studying on what to do, how to make out. Well, I done decided, and when I say what I come to say, I want y'all to know there ain't no disrespect to her intended."
Grandpa opened the door wider. He was about to light his firecrackers.
"Now, what I come to say," he blurted out, "is I'm aiming to marry Miss Love Simpson."
Mama's and Aunt Loma's mouths dropped open and their faces went white. They both cried out,
"Pa, you can't."
"I done asked her and she's done said yes. And Loma, there ain't a bloomin' thing you can do about it."
Aunt Loma's face got as red as if she'd been on the river all day, but it was Mama who finally spoke. In a timid voice, she said,
"Sir, Love Simpson's young enough to be your daughter. She's no more than 33 or 34 years old."
"That ain't got a thing to do with it."
Mama put both hands up to her mouth. With a sort of whimper, she said,
"Pa, don't you care what folks are going to say?"
"I care about you caring what they'll say, Mary Willis, but I care heap more about not being no burden on y'all, so hish up."
Aunt Loma was about to burst.
"Think, Pa," she ordered, tears streaming down her face.
Just think, Ma hasn't been dead but 3 weeks.
Well, good gosh almighty, he thundered. She's dead as she'll ever be, ain't she? Well, ain't she?
Chapter 2. I thought Mama was going to faint. She stumbled toward her daddy, arms outstretched, but Grandpa glared at her and she stepped back. I'm lonesome, he said it kind of quiet. Then he hugged each weeping daughter and walked out of the door, hitching up his trousers with the stub of his left arm. On the veranda, Grandpa turned back and spoke his defense. I ain't going to be no burden on y'all, not ever. Which means I got to hire me a colored woman or get married, one. And tell you the truth, it's just cheaper to have a wife. So I'm a-goin' marry Miss Love. And I ain't got but one more thing to say. All y'all be nice to her, you hear? He said all y'all, but it was Aunt Loma he glared at when he said it. With that, my grandfather stalked tall down the steps. We watched as he strode past Mama's pots of pink begonias and Papa's life-size iron stag and walked through the iron gate. Banging it shut, he passed the tall pink crepe myrtles that lined the dirt sidewalk in front of our house, crossed the dirt street called South Main, went over the railroad tracks onto North Main, and headed for the store. Soon as Grandpa got out of sight, it was as if somebody had wound Mama and Aunt Loma up and let go the spring. Mama wailed that she could never show her face in Cold Sassy again. She was so embarrassed. Aunt Loma was just plain mad. Remember Ma's funeral headline, sister? She spat out the words. Mama nodded into her handkerchief. Yes, of course I do. It said, grieving husband left to walk through life alone. I can just see the engagement notice. Grieving widower finds woman to walk with. You know Bubba wouldn't do that, Mama cried. Bubba Reynolds was editor of the Cold Sassy Weekly. He will if he thinks of it, said Loma. Sister, that woman ought to be ashamed, and I'm going to go tell her so. Mama was alarmed. Now, Loma, once you get started, you don't know when to hush. Then she added, but it might do some good to tell her how stingy Pa is and how hard he is to cook for. That might make her think twice. There was a silence, except for Aunt Loma pounding her right fist into her left hand. Bam, 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 glaring at me as she did it. Finally, she said my daddy might could talk Grandpa out of it. Mama didn't think so. Hort don't even dare ask Pa to raise his pay. Get your camp onto him. She was being sarcastic. I'd heard her say that Grandpa thought Uncle Camp was still in knee breeches. Aunt Loma didn't answer. She knew, they both knew, that nobody could stand up to their daddy. Then Loma shook both fists in the direction of the store. Dog bite your hide, Love Simpson, she screamed, and dog bite yours, Pa. Loma, hush, the neighbors will... How could he do it, and her a Yankee? Mama was always fair, even when frustrated to distraction. Now, Loma, everybody calls Miss Love a Yankee, and she does kind of talk like one, but Maryland is not a northern state. Then, as another thought struck her, Mama collapsed onto the leather davenport there in the front hall. Loma, she wailed, Pa didn't have on his black armband. Well, should he, sister, when he's engaged? Aunt Loma liked to choke on the word engaged. But they can't marry for a year or more. I don't see why Pa couldn't wear an armband for Ma. While Love Simpson wears an engagement ring for Pa. Surely he won't give her a ring. He just said he wanted us to know, not the whole world. Mama jumped up and stuck her nose right in her young sister's face. Now you listen to me. Loma backed off a little. I want you to keep your mouth shut. It may all blow over and nobody'll ever know. Maybe Pa just thought she said yes. Grandpa ain't hard of hearing, said I, but they didn't seem to notice. I was amazed at Mama. She was usually just the mildest sort of person. Ordinarily, if anybody was saying hush up around here, it was Aunt Loma, despite she was 14 years younger than my mother. No doubt Aunt Loma marveled, too, because she didn't say anything sassy back. Just jerked off her genteel black veil and threw it hard as she could towards the front door. Sister, I was fixin' to ask Pa for Ma's piano, she burst out. Tears of frustration wet her red face. And I want the mirror that couldn't pearl painted St. Cecilia on. Just think, while I was waiting a decent time to ask for a piano and a mirror, come to find out he was asking for a wife. Screaming the words out, she stomped her foot. I knew Mama wanted the piano so Mary Toy could take music lessons. Mama always liked the St. Cecilia mirror, too. Everybody in Cold Sassy except us had St. Cecilia painted on something. And though Mama wasn't the kind to ask for things, I'd heard her tell Queenie she was going to see if her pa would let her swap our mismatched parlor furniture for Granny's nice parlor suit. She knew he wouldn't care one way or the other. "I just can't understand it," Mama fumed, getting up to pace the hall just the way Grandpa had. "I thought Love Simpson would marry Son Black. I know his mother don't approve, but he's not getting any younger, and they've been courting a year or more." "And Love deserves him," said Aunt Loma. She used to be sweet on Son Black herself, so I reckon she knew what she was talking about when she added, "Son's right nice-looking and smart, but his mouth sure isn't any prayer book, and he's meaner than a snake." "Yeah," I chimed in. "I heard he had him a pet snake one time that bit him, and the next day the snake died." They ignored that. Mama said, "Love is too used to town life and dressing fashionable. Maybe she don't care to stay out there on the farm with Son's mama and raise children. Maybe she thinks she's too good to marry a farmer." "Shoot," retorted Aunt Loma. "What about that ranch out in Texas she was engaged to before she came here? A rancher has lots of land and money, but he's a farmer just the same. Lord, I wish to heaven she'd married him. If only he hadn't..." "Shh," Mama nodded toward me. I knew Loman was fixing to say, "If only he hadn't got Miss Love's best friend in trouble and had to marry her." Everybody in town knew that story. I don't know why Mama thought I didn't. Nobody asked my opinion, but I had always admired Miss Love, with all that wavy brown hair piled atop her head, and that smiley, freckledy face, and those friendly gray-blue eyes. She was a merry person, like Grandpa. Always wore big flowered hats and bright-colored dresses, never quiet clothes like nice ladies were supposed to wear on the street. I could see how Miss Love could cheer up a man whose wife was short of breath for 4 years, dying for 10 days and dead for 3 weeks. Aunt Loma's face suddenly went redder than ever. Clearly she'd had a new thought.
"Sister, with Love being Pa's milliner, and them seeing each other down at the store every day, people are going to say..."
"Well, I thought I told you to go get the eggs,"
Mom interrupted with a mad sound in her voice.
"Now go on right now, mind me."
I minded her, but she needn't think I didn't know what Aunt Loma was driving at. Well, there couldn't have been any carrying on down at the store, or we'd have heard about it long time ago. Anyhow, Miss Love wasn't that kind, and neither was my grandfather. And heck, he loved Granny. Even now, I couldn't hardly imagine him kissing another lady or slapping her playful on the backside like he used to do Granny when he was in a teasing mood. I guess what I really couldn't imagine was Miss Love kissing him, much less marrying him. It was easy to see he needed looking after, but what did she need that an old man could give when she already had a beau her own age who was anxious to marry her? Chapter 3. I sat down on the back steps to think. I didn't see why Mama and Aunt Loma weren't glad Grandpa Blakesley had found him a lady to marry. The sooner the better, if you asked me. The wedding couldn't be for a year or more, of course, but after that he wouldn't have to keep coming to our house for dinner or to Aunt Loma's every night for supper, which he'd been doing ever since Granny passed away. And Miss Love wouldn't have to bring a quart mason jar full of hot coffee down to the store for him every morning like she'd been doing. Papa kept trying to get Grandpa to eat breakfast with us, being as he came by home anyhow for his snort. It wouldn't have been much trouble for Mama. All Grandpa ever wanted in the morning was 4 cups of coffee and some yeast bread, toasted hard and dipped in boiling water and then buttered. But when Papa said, "Sit down and have a bite with us, Mr. Blakesley," Grandpa would say he just did. I reckon he thought if he took dinner and breakfast both at our house, it wouldn't be any time before Papa would be after him to move in with us. Well, this time next year, Grandpa would be married, and if he didn't like what was put before him, it would be Miss Love's little red wagon, not Mama's or Aunt Loma's. Also, they wouldn't have to see after him if he got sick. He was hard to take care of when he was ailing, liked to groan and carry on. He'd lie down before supper on the day bed moaning, "Oh, me, me, oh, me, me," and Granny just about went crazy listening to it, knowing that next morning he'd go on to the store anyway. Last year, too, no matter how bad he felt, you couldn't make him stay home. He could have had a cold so bad it sounded like pneumonia rattling around in there, but he wouldn't stay home. That really used to worry my grandmother. She'd beg him not to go to work. "Mr. Blakesley, I nurse everybody in town but my own husband. please stay in bed tomorrow, hear? But he'd say, I ain't that big of a fool, Miss Mattie Lou. Ain't you ever noticed? Folks die in bed. Anyhow, now there wouldn't be any more worrying about Grandpa living by himself. Aunt Loma had already declared he couldn't live with her, said she didn't have room. I don't know how she could say such as that when her daddy had given her husband a job and provided them a house to live in. Mama couldn't have said it, even if he didn't own our house too, and even if Papa didn't work for him. Papa had been keeping the store ledgers since he was 16. Grandpa wouldn't have lived with Aunt Loma, of course, on account of her cats. The first time he went there for supper after Granny was buried, the next morning he started fussing about her cats the minute he got to our house for his snort. I swan it to God, I seen one of them cats jump up on Loma's kitchen stove last night, tiptoed across that red-hot stove on his dang claws and ate right out of the pot. I'd been hoping Grandpa would come live with us, but even though she never said so, I knew Mama dreaded that possibility. Tell the truth, she was scared of her daddy, as if she wasn't sure he'd got over her not being a boy and her marrying a Presbyterian, though the way I heard it from Cuddin Temp, Grandpa was all for her marrying my daddy and had a fit when the Baptist deacons tried her for heresy. Heresy was his word for their word for her marrying a Presbyterian. According to Temp, the deacons voted to put it in the church records that Mary Willis Blakesley has swapped her religious birthright for a mess of matrimonial pottage. It made Grandpa mad as holy heck. "Anybody calls Hoyt Tweedy a mess of matrimonial pottage," he roared, "that man is going to answer to me." The deacons struck the pottage part from the record, but they turned Mama out of the Baptist communion just the same, and her only 17. That was one reason I didn't like the way Mama was carrying on so about Grandpa getting engaged. He had stuck up for her when she wanted to marry Papa. Why wouldn't she stick up for him now? I wasn't surprised at Aunt Loma, of course. She was the only child of Granny and Grandpa's to live more than a few years, besides my mother, and she'd been spoiled all her life. I reckon they thought they had to keep rewarding her for not dying. Anyhow, Loma never could think about much else for thinking about how to get her own way. Despite she was married now and a mother, she hadn't grown up any that I could see. If it didn't suit her for Daddy to marry again, why, he just wasn't going to. Miss Love, having worked for Grandpa at his store for 2 years or more, she must already know he was stingy and set in his ways. She also knew that, because of his having just the one hand, he needed special looking after. He bit off his fingernails, so keeping them short was no problem. But tough meat had to be cut up for him, and he needed help with his high-top shoes. Timmy Hopkins had been coming by to tie Grandpa's shoelaces ever since Granny took sick. But though Miss Love might not be a good cook after boarding so long, and probably couldn't have outworked Granny in a vegetable garden or rose garden or sick room, most anybody could outdo Granny with a broom and a feather duster. She used to say, "A house will keep whether you weed it or not, but that air yard will get away from you in the bat of an eye." The only thing she liked to do indoors was cook and tend the sick. I remember one time she pulled off her apron after 2 days and nights nursing a neighbor lady and said, "They ain't no feeling in the world like taking on somebody wilted and near about gone, and you do what you can, then all of a sudden the poor thing starts to put out new growth and get well." I had never heard of Miss Love nursing the sick, but that wasn't any reason for Grandpa not to marry her. I just couldn't see why Mama and Aunt Loma were having a fit about it. The fact that I liked Miss Love didn't mean I hadn't loved Granny, and I figured it was the same with him. I was just fixing to get up off the back steps and go gather the eggs when Campbell Jr. started squalling in the kitchen. I heard Aunt Loma go in there. "I got to get on home," she told our cook. "Yes'm," said Queenie. "Bess is ill hot. He be's hungry." "And I be's full as a Jersey cow," said Aunt Loma, mocking her. "Seems like all I do is nurse this bloomin' baby." "Shame on you, Miss Loma, talking like that. Some peoples can't nurse they baby, and some ain't got nary baby to nurse. You be as lucky." "Humph," said Loma, and left. Before I had a chance to move, Mama came out and lit into me for sitting there doing nothing. Said I was no count and shiftless, and why hadn't I gathered the eggs, and I was supposed to have weeded the lower garden 2 days ago, and to go do that. But first you gather the eggs like you been told to. You gon' let the rats get 'em. Or that no-count egg-sucker dog of yours?" I resented that. T.R. didn't suck eggs, but I said yes'm. Mama went inside, and I was hardly down the three back steps before she stuck her head out of her bedroom window upstairs and hollered for me to watch for Papa and my Grandpa when it was time for them to come to dinner. "Yes'm." "I got a sick headache," she said, like it was my fault, and put her hand up to her forehead as she faded back into the room. The window slammed shut, and the shade came down to keep it cool in there. In a kind of furious daze, forgetting the eggs, I got a big old great peach basket off the porch and dragged it down the path. The garden was to the left of the barn and the pasture, hidden from the house by the smokehouse and a pecan grove and a row of little peach trees that because of the drought had dropped hard, knotty fruit not even fit to make spiced pickle with. Gourd leaves that yesterday drooped down like 100 little half-closed umbrellas were now freshened with dew. But it was already hot, great goodness, and the dirt was powder dry. I hadn't weeded since the last rain. I started pulling up the grass and weeds as if they were Miss Love Simpson, like I thought getting rid of them would get rid of her and bring Granny Blakesley back from the grave and let us be a normal family again. Nothing had been normal since Granny died. Mama was grieving herself to death, Papa was sterner than ever, Aunt Loma was meaner, the laughter had gone out of Grandpa, and if he was about to sell the store, it wouldn't have upset everybody any more than him aiming to marry his milliner. Worst of all for me was being in mourning. I just didn't think I could stand any more mourning. For 3 whole weeks of summer vacation, they hadn't let me play baseball or go fishing or anything. I couldn't mention the camping trip I'd been planning all spring with Pink Predmore and Leroy Sleep and Smiley Snodgrass, and I'd missed a chance to ride in a Buick automobile all the way to Atlanta. Pink's uncle over in Athens invited him and me to go so we could fix his flat tires and push the car up hills and out of ditches if it rained and the roads got slick. Pink went, but Mama wouldn't let me go. Also, I didn't get to go downtown for the 4th of July parade, and they hadn't let me read the funny paper since the day Granny passed on. Papa never had let us read the funny paper on Sunday. That was a sin. We had to save it till Monday. But now we were having to save the funnies indefinitely, and sometimes the newspaper got taken to start a fire with before I could tear out the page. The Cats and Jammer kids had dropped clean out of my life. Seems like I missed them about as much as I missed Granny. Maybe more. They were up there on the shelf in Mama's chiffarobe with things happening to them, whereas Granny wasn't anywhere. I wish she could come back for just a minute. I'd ask her, wouldn't she hate my giving up the funnies and the automobile trip when there wasn't a thing I could do for her anymore? Despite she wanted a nice funeral, I knew she wouldn't expect a boy to walk around with a long face the rest of his life. I was just fixing to quit weeding and rest a spell under the big hickory-nut tree when I noticed my shadow was underfoot, nearly straight down. It must be right at dinner time. Gosh, Mama had told me to watch out for Papa and Grandpa. Dashing past the barn, the smokehouse, and Mama's flower pit, I ran through the house and got to the front door just as Papa hurried up the walk. He was by himself. "Where's Grandpa at?" I asked. "Where's Mama at?" he asked. He was sweaty and red-faced from rushing home, and he looked upset. "She's gone to bed, sir. I think she's sick." Even now, 8 years later, I remember how my papa looked that day, like a thundercloud, but also like a pitiful lightning-struck tree. Taking the stairs 2 at a time, he didn't even notice me following behind. As he burst into the darkened second-floor bedroom, he said, "Mary Willis, guess what? Your daddy just left in his buggy with Miss Love Simpson. Said they were off to Jefferson to get married." Mama bolted up. "You mean already?" she screeched. "Today?" "You knew it?" roared Papa. "Why didn't you tell me?" "I didn't dream he meant today." Then she blurted out what all Grandpa had said that morning. "What he said it didn't matter, said Ma having just passed away didn't matter. He said Ma was dead as she..." She started crying. "Dead as... Oh, Hoyt, I can't bear to repeat his words. He said Ma was as dead as she'd ever be." Peeping in the doorway, I saw my mother was laying across the bed on her side, pressing a handkerchief to her mouth. Papa had sat down by her and was patting her shoulder. He kissed her forehead. "There, there, Mary Willis, hon, don't carry on so. I admit it, I was surprised myself. But Lord knows Mr. Blakesley needs somebody to see after him. Hon, I'm sure Miss Love will be good to him. She'll get the store, that's what she'll do," cried Mama. "And this house, maybe everything he owns. What if she has a baby, Hoyt? Did you think about that?
And what if she marries again after Pa dies? Oh, Hoyt.
I knew my mother thought the marriage was a scandal, but this was the first I guessed that she saw Miss Love as a scoundrel, a villain, out to steal hers and Aunt Loma's inheritance. Slowly it dawned on me that if Grandpa Blakesley died and left Miss Love the store, she really could marry again and let her new husband run it. And if he was somebody like Son Black, he might just push my daddy and Uncle Camp clean out. The threat was sobering even to me. But somehow the picture didn't fit. Maybe Grandpa didn't care what folks said or thought about him, but he cared a lot about Mama and Papa and Aunt Loma. I mean, he didn't like Aunt Loma a lot, but he loved her. Also, he set great store in a man doing right by his family. Peeping in again, I saw Papa had his arm around Mama. She was crying.
"When a woman marries a man old enough to be her father," she said, "you can bet your bottom dollar it's for what she can get out of him. Pa's a fool, Hoyt. Oh, I just don't see how we can start all over when he dies. Oh, Hoyt."
She kept wailing and Papa kept patting her. I didn't know what to think about all that, but I knew I didn't want them to catch me out there listening. Tiptoeing around to the other side of a golden oak bureau that was in the hall near their bedroom door, I squatted down.
"I'm sick over the whole thing," Mama muttered. "Just sick. No telling what kind of family she comes from. There's a milliner in Athens who trained with Love in Baltimore, and she says Love's daddy fought on the Union side in the war. That by itself should have made Pa think twice, feeling like he does about Yankees. Hoyt, we don't even know what her father does, for heaven's sake, or whether the family has any education or background or any standing at all in their community."
Mama was a great one for not marrying beneath yourself. Papa argued that the family surely must be educated, judging by the way Miss Love talked so proper. "She seems like somebody with background."
"Well, one thing I know, Miss Predmore says the only letters Love Simpson gets from Baltimore are from the millinery company that trained her. The postmaster told her. We figure she must be ashamed of her folks. If she don't write them and don't hear from them and don't ever say pea turkey about them to anybody, something's wrong."
"Please, hon, don't get yourself all wrought up."
"Her family could be common as Camp's folks for all we know. Ignorant, no count, even low down. I still don't see how Loma could have married into that sharecropper white trash. With all her education and advantages, she's got a daddy-in-law who can't read or write and a mother-in-law who dips snuff. And Camp's sisters work in the fields just like colored girls. Thank the Lord they didn't come to the wedding."
Papa couldn't stand it when Mama got to low-rating Uncle Camp's people. "Now, hon, that don't have anything to do with your pa."
"It does, too. Even if Love's folks ain't ignorant, they could be deadbeats. Jesus said, 'Take up your cross and follow me,' but he didn't ask us to go out and nail ourselves to a board. Some fine day, mark my words, Love's family will get off the train from Baltimore to come live off of Pa, just like Camp's folks are going to be living off of he and Loma before it's over. Or maybe living with them. Only reason Loma married Camp, she was mad 'cause Pa wouldn't let her go off with those actors. That's just exactly why. She was bound and determined to get her way about something, just to spite Pa."
It was true. A touring Shakespeare company had let Loma try out after their performance in Cold Sassy's Brush Arbor, and then asked her to join the troupe. Everybody in town said, "Lord help Loma if she ends up an actress. Even if she got rich and famous and did command performances for Edward VII like she said she would, she couldn't ever live down the taint." But Grandpa said, "Loma, I ain't going to let you do it. Ain't no telling what kind of a life you'd live with them kind of folks." She stomped and cried and carried on something awful.
"I wish I was a boy so I could go off on my own."
"I wish you was a boy too, but you ain't," Grandpa retorted. "And you ain't gonna be no actress neither, so hush up."
Loma went to her room and threw things, but Grandpa didn't hear it. He had gone on back to the store. I myself used to wonder why Loma didn't find some more actors to run off with, a thing she wanted to do, instead of marrying Campbell Williams just to spite her daddy. Well, and now her daddy had married Miss Love, maybe partly to spite Cold Sassy.
"Loma and Pa, they're just alike," Mama was fuming. "They don't ever consider anybody else, neither one of them. When I think of the nice widder's Pa's age who'd be happy to marry him, I don't see why he had to pick an old maid from up north who's had to work for a living."
In Cold Sassy, ladies who work for pay are looked down on, except school teachers or widow women with no close kinfolks to turn to. Milliners are considered in a class with store clerks and telephone hello girls.
"Why wouldn't Pa let me look after him?" Mama went on. "We could have moved up to his house."
"And go back to using lamps and privies?" asked Papa irritably.
"And give up Queenie?"
Grandpa didn't have electricity or running water and didn't believe in hiring colored help. That silenced my mother, but only for a minute. In a new burst of tears, she said,
"Hoy, Pa has disgraced the whole family, the whole town."
Most likely, Papa was patting her shoulder again. "It's gonna turn out all right, hon. Just don't forget I work for him and Camp works for him. Y'all have got to be nice to Miss Love. Now, hon, I need to get back to the store. Please, let's go eat."
"You and Will eat?"
Mama's muffled voice came out of her pillow.
"I'm not hungry. The nerve, that woman thinking she can take Ma's place. And everybody's gonna say, you mark my words, they gonna say Pa must have been sweet on her from the day he laid eyes on her. It's like he just couldn't hardly wait for Ma to pass."
I guess my mother didn't notice that Papa had left the room. I waited till he got downstairs before I crept down myself. I couldn't stand hearing her keep on talking against Grandpa. Chapter 4. I used to try to undress Grandpa Blakesley's face in my mind and think how he'd look clean-shaved. I never could picture him like that, but I liked looking at him the way he was. His eyes merry, his upper lip hidden under the droopy mustache, his bushy gray beard usually stained here and there with tobacco juice. Most people thought I was his spitting image. Granny used to say I walked like Grandpa, twitched my shoulders like him, can't neither one of y'all set still, and looked like him, except for your eyes being brown and his'n so blue, and the fact your nose ain't humped. Grandpa's nose had got broke 3 times, and it showed. First time he was trying to fly. I was maybe 12 years old, jumped out in a hayloft holding a dang umbrella, and it turned inside out. The other 2 times his nose got busted in fist fights. At 59, Grandpa still had all his teeth, which should be a comfort to Miss Love. He only wore glasses to read. He was lean, strong, straight, and taller than most men, the way I was taller than most 14-year-old boys. My grandmother was small. She could stand under his arm if he stuck it straight out, and never could keep up with him when they walked together. His long legs swung in giant strides. She trotted at his heels like a good little dog. Grandpa was a buster, all right. He was a Democrat, a Baptist, and a devout Confederate veteran. The words Abraham Lincoln couldn't be spoken in his presence. His only hand was soft and smooth, not like the rough, red, calloused hands of farmers. In a fight, he used the elbow of his left arm as a deflector and his fightin' right to punch with. The fights were embarrassing to the family, but real entertaining to the Baptists, for he would stand up at the next Wednesday night prayer meeting in the testimonial and confessing part and tell the Lord all about it. One Wednesday night, he ended a long prayer with, "Lord, forgive me for fitting that man yesterday. Though thou knowest if I had to do it over again, I'd hit him harder." Grandpa was a good shot with a pistol. He never went hunting, but he could prop a Winchester rifle on a fence and shoot into the mouth of a Coca-Cola bottle 50 feet away and not even chip the glass, except for the hole at the bottom where the bullet came out. I never could figure why Mama and Papa let him keep his quart jars of moonshine in the closet in our company room. At the time, Papa made and drank locust beer, and Mama made scuppernong and blackberry wines for church communion. After the Georgia legislature declared a prohibition against alcoholic beverages in 1907, Papa quit making a drinking beer, he believed in being law-abiding, and the churches started using fruit nectars instead of wine. But even before prohibition, neither Papa nor Mama could stand whiskey drinking. Yet there stood those jars of corn whiskey on our closet shelf. Why couldn't my daddy ask him to keep them down at the store? Or after Granny died and wasn't there anymore to disallow it, why didn't he take the stuff to his own house? My parents never once spoke of his drinking in front of me or Mary Toy. Acted like he just went in the company room to hitch up his suspenders or something. But I doubt they could have said anything even if he hadn't been Mama's papa and Papa's employer. Grandpa had the manner of a king or duke. When he said do or don't do something, you said yes, sir, before you thought. And if he said he meant to do something, like keep his corn whiskey in your closet or marry Miss Love Simpson, if you couldn't say yes, sir, you sure dog didn't say no, sir. Not out loud. What I admired most was his flair for practical jokes. That was a way of life you could learn early, as I discovered when I was little bitty and Cud and Doodle told me to lick a frozen wagon wheel and my tongue stuck to the ice. Playing jokes didn't have to stop because you got grown. Grandpa must have been 25 at least when he turned over the privy at the depot with a Yankee Railroad bigwig in it. I didn't want to be like my grandfather in all ways. I thought I wanted to be like Papa, at least sometime in the distant future. But right now, Grandpa was more fun than Papa, and didn't worry near as much, if at all, about sin. And he was real proud of me. I was the son he never had. While I was still in dresses, he put me to sorting nails at the store and getting out rotten apples and potatoes. By the time I was 7, he let me make deliveries for him in my goat cart. It was his notion that when I got grown, he would give me an interest in the store and take me into partnership. It was my notion to be a farmer. Papa wanted to buy the old home place out in Banks County from his daddy and let me run it. But at the time Grandpa Blakesley married Miss Love, I still hadn't got up the nerve to tell him my plans. Most folks thought, as Miss Effie Bell Tate put it, that Grandpa was both rich and well-to-do. For sure, he was one of Cold Sassy's leading merchants. Had him a big brick store with mahogany counters, beveled glass mirrors, and big colored signs for Coca-Cola, Mother's Friend, take to make childbirth easier, Fletcher's Castoria, Old Dutch Cleanser, McKesson and Robbins Liniment, and all like that. I like to look at the advertisements in the mail-order catalogs he kept by the cash register. Manhood Restored was my favorite. Nerve seeds guaranteed to cure all nervous diseases such as weak memory, loss of brain power, headaches, wakefulness, lost manhood, nightly emissions, nervousness, all drain and loss of power in generative organs of either sex caused by overexertion, youthful errors, excessive use of tobacco, opium, or stimulants which lead to infirmity, consumption, or insanity. Can be carried in vest pocket. $1 per box. Address Nerve Seed Company, Masonic Temple, Chicago, Illinois. Grandpa had him a big sign out front over the entrance to the store. In fancy red letters outlined in gold, it said, General Merchandise, Mr. E. Rucker Blakesley, Proprietor. Besides keeping the store's ledgers, my daddy took a lot of the buying trips to Atlanta and Baltimore and New York City. I went to New York with him one time when I was little bitty. I'd heard about damn Yankees all my life, and there I was in a city just full of them. It scared me to death. Granny's Uncle Lige Toy, who used to have a restaurant business feeding county prisoners, was in charge of Grandpa's cotton warehouse, one of the biggest in North Georgia, and also the store's cottonseed business. Uncle Lige was the one to talk to if you wanted to put your bales in storage till you could get a better price. A third cousin of Papa's, Hopewell Stump, from out in Banks County, clerked and took care of the chickens that folks brought to trade out for nails, flour, sugar, coal oil, coffee, and chewing tobacco. There used to be smelly chicken coops out on the board sidewalk in front of every store in town, but after Cold Sassy was incorporated in 1887, the Baptist Missionary Society ladies petitioned the town council to get rid of them. So when Grandpa built his brick store in 1892, he put a great big chicken house in back, and every Friday Cud and Hope shipped hens, roosters, and frying-sized pullets to Athens or Atlanta on the train. Uncle Camp mostly swept the floor and put out stock, and in the wintertime broke up wooden shipping crates to burn in the stove. Grandpa called him born tired and raised lazy. Said getting him to finish something was like pushing mud. Money don't jump out at you, boy, he'd say. You gotta work for it. Campbell Williams was Uncle Camp's whole name. He was a pale, thin fellow with pale, thin yellow hair and a pale, thin personality. He was always checking the time so he could show off his gold pocket watch. He wasn't but 19 when he came to Cold Sassy from over near Maysville, Georgia. The day Camp walked into the store and asked for a job, Grandpa took one look and said he didn't need no help right now. Camp got him a job at the tannery working for Wildcat Lindsay, but soon lost it, and then worked a while at the gin. Grandpa didn't bring him into the store till after he married Aunt Loma, and never did have any respect for him. Love Simpson was the first woman Grandpa ever hired. She grew up in Baltimore and had never married but didn't look or act like any other old maid in town. She was tall, plump, and big-bosomed, stood very straight, moved lively, and wore flouncy, fashionable clothes. Miss Love had a sparkly way of talking, and she laughed a lot. I remember the first time I saw her. I'd been standing in front of the store watching a flock of turkeys trot through town. If a turkey strayed, a man would snap a long whip around its neck and pull it back in line. When I went inside, there was the new milliner, seated at a table littered with feathers, bird wings, satin bows, stiff tape, bolts of velvet, linen, silk, and so on, and several life-size dummy heads. She had one of the heads in her lap, wrapping folds of pink velour around it and sticking pins here and there to hold the cloth in place. Looking up, she saw me, smiled, and said, "What's all the commotion outside, honey?" She had two pins in the corner of her mouth and had to speak around them. "A turkey drive, ma'am. The men are rushing to get 'em through town before first dark, 'cause when it's time to roost, they're going to fly to the nearest tree, and they ain't going to budge till daybreak." I was only 12 then. It was before I got long-legged, so with her sitting down and me standing, my head was just about level with hers. I forgot all about the turkeys. I was so busy smelling her perfume and looking at her freckles. They were like brown pepper. She had gray blue eyes, long black lashes, a tilted up nose, a big smiley mouth, and thick wavy brown hair piled high and perky on her head. Miss Love took the pins out of her mouth. "I guess you live here in Cold Sassy," she said, smiling extra friendly. "Yes'm, I'm Will Tweedy, ma'am. You must be the new milliner." "And you must be Mr. Hoyt's boy." She nodded in the direction of Papa, who was over by the cash register. "Yes'm. He is a very nice man, and good-looking, too." That pleased me. Papa was stocky, not tall, but he was neat about his clothes, had a handsome face, and shaved every morning. Most men in Cold Sassy had a beard or just shaved on Saturday night to get ready for Sunday. Miss Love held up the dummy head with the pink velour wrapping, turning it this way and that to get the effect. "You like this hat, Will Tweedy?" I didn't have much opinion about hats or much interest either. "Well," I mumbled, "I can't hardly tell what it's going to look like yet." Miss Love laughed, a hearty laugh. Her lips were so red they looked painted almost. "You're a good diplomat, Will Tweedy." One thing I noticed that day was how proper Miss Love spoke. Till then, I never met anybody who could talk as proper as Aunt Carrie. Aunt Carrie was taught to speak cultured at a private school in Athens run by a French woman, Madame Joubert. I found out later that Miss Love learned to talk right from a rich, educated lady in Philadelphia that she used to go stay with every spring and fall, making hats for her and her daughters. "Mrs. Hanover was always correcting my grammar and pronunciation," Miss Love told me. "If I mumbled or made the least little mistake, I had to say it over and over till I got it right." I guess Mrs. Hanover liked me. She said that with my flair for fashion, her friends couldn't tell me from one of them till I opened my mouth. "Cultivate good speech, Miss Simpson," she'd say, "and you can marry above yourself." She gave me her finishing school grammar book. I still have it. I felt certain if I memorized that book, I could marry the Prince of Wales, or at least a railroad president. Grandpa was real proud of the store having a milliner trained at the Armstrong and Cater Company in Baltimore. In 1901, the company had sent Miss Love and her best friend out to a big store in Texas. When she wanted to leave Texas, Armstrong and Cater sent her sight unseen to Grandpa. He had written asking for a milliner, and Miss Love was available, so that's all there was to it. But for weeks after she came to town, men would poke Grandpa in the ribs, nod toward the milliner's table, and say, "You sure know how to pick 'em, Mr. Blakesley, or you got you a real looker, ain't you?" Grandpa would grin and say, "You dang right." At first, Miss Love stayed at Granny and Grandpa's house in their company room. Later, she boarded with Mr. and Mrs. Eli P. Crabtree, whose son Arthur was bad to drink and took an overdose of laudanum in the cemetery one cold night. They found him dead the next morning, huddled up against his sweetheart's tombstone, and now Miss Love was renting Arthur's old room. The Crabtrees thought she was real nice, but she didn't tell her business to them or anybody and didn't have close friends. The only thing Cold Sassy knew about her was what that milliner in Athens told Aunt Loma. Besides about her daddy being in the Union Army, the woman told it as gospel that after Miss Love got engaged to a rich Texas rancher and went home to Maryland to make her trousseau clothes, her best friend got you-know-what by her fiance, and they eloped. Aunt Loma said if her fiance and her best friend were that kind of trash, it don't speak so well for Love Simpson. You have to take it into account that Aunt Loma was just 18 when Miss Love hit town, and the jealous type. Aunt Loma was blue-eyed and had the thickest, long, curly red hair you ever saw, with little tendrils around her face that made her look sweet and innocent. Till Miss Love came, she was considered just the prettiest thing in Cold Sassy, and also the most fashionable. While visiting one time in Atlanta, Loma went to M. Rich and Brothers and bought herself some handmade French drawers with lace-edged ruffles, and also what she called a blue polka-dot foulard dress with an overskirt of georgette crepe. Grandpa liked to have a fit about her spending the money, but after she cried, he let her alone about it. The only thing not fashionable about Aunt Loma was her bosom. She was so flat you didn't have to be big to be bigger, and Miss Love Simpson was definitely bigger. At some point, Miss Love made the mistake of remarking that Loma had just the perfect figure for the stylish new shirtwaists with lots of tucks and ruffles in front. That was because of Loma's flat busts, so though it was meant as a compliment, she was insulted. She hadn't had much to do with Miss Love since, especially not after one Saturday when she wanted to buy a little blue hat with white bird wings on it that Miss Love was wearing and didn't want to sell. I heard what was said because I was down at the store washing fly spots off the show window. "You've sold hats off your head before," Aunt Loma argued, pushing out her bottom lip. "I know," Miss Love answered sweetly, "but I made this hat special to go with this dress. Let me fix up something else for you." Aunt Loma's face flushed red as her hair. She was so mad, and she flounced off acting like a store owner's daughter to a hired hand. "I must say, Love Simpson," she hissed, "you'd do well to quit thinking you're good as your betters." As they say in Cold Sassy, Aunt Loma was behind the door when they passed out the tact. And her temper was such that if King Edward VII or the Lord God Almighty himself had been around when she got mad, she wouldn't have talked any less awful. In fact, she'd have been glad of the extra audience. I just couldn't stand Aunt Loma. As long as I could remember, she'd bossed me like I was her slave. She was only 6 years older than me, for gosh sake, which to my mind didn't give her any right to lord it over me like she was 100. God help Miss Love Simpson if she really had gone off and married Grandpa against her will. Against Aunt Loma's will, I mean. I hoped Miss Love understood what she was up against. I could have told her because I'd been up against Aunt Loma all my life. There were some people in Cold Sassy who called Miss Love that Yankee woman or made fun of her for being a suffragette. Not a man in town thought it mattered a hoot about women voting, and only two ladies went to the first women's suffrage meeting Miss Love set up. Either nobody else was interested or their husbands wouldn't let them come, one. After that meeting, most folks felt a little uneasy about Miss Love. Still in all, just about everybody liked her. The men liked her because she was pretty and friendly and, as Mr. Craddock Flournoy put it, full of ginger and pepper. The ladies liked her because she made hats that could have come straight out of New York City. Also, she had a pattern book of the newest styles and would order patterns for anybody who wanted her to, and she showed the ladies how to fix their hair fashionable. The congregation at the Methodist Episcopal Church South liked her because her piano playing was loud and lively. Ever since Miss Love started playing for preaching, folks had sung out good, patting their feet and generally getting in shape to shout an amen during the sermon. Just the same, Cold Sassy thought it was one thing to like Miss Love and another thing entirely to marry her, especially if your wife died just 3 weeks ago. Chapter 5. As Mama expected, there wasn't anybody in Cold Sassy who didn't wonder if Grandpa hadn't been sweet on the milliner a long time, and maybe was relieved to get shed of Miss Matty Lou so he could marry Miss Love. For sure, Miss Love wasn't a bit like Granny, except they were both feisty. Granny always wore her skimpy gray hair pulled straight back behind her ears and fastened in a ball. I never saw frill or ribbon on her, and I figured she had never been pretty. She told me that when she and her cousin were young, they walked by the harness shop one day and chanced to hear an old man say what nice girls they were. Another man said, "Yeah, but one of them sure is strange around the eyes." "We never knowed which one he meant," Granny said, laughing. I knew which one. It was Granny. Her eyes were the farthest apart I ever saw. She had big ears, too, and the last few months a peculiar knot came on one side of her throat. It wasn't a goiter. Doc Slaughter said blamed if he knew what it was. Grandpa teased her about it. "You look like you done swallowed a goose egg, Miss Matty Lou, and it got stuck in your goozle." She just laughed. She was kind of worried about the knot, but really didn't care how it looked, and Grandpa didn't either. Her not having a baby boy was the only thing Grandpa ever threw up to her. Once I saw tears come in her eyes when he mentioned it. Granny used to say she never did see why Mr. Blakesley married her. When he'd come back to Cold Sassy after the war, he was the handsomest man you ever seen, and I was an old maid. 21-year-old, never had a beau in my life. I was fixing to go into church one Sunday morning when this good-looking fella, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Ain't you Miss Mattie Lou Toyer? You don't need no sermon today. Stay out here and let's talk." I ain't seen him since the fourth grade, but I knowed it was Rucker Blakesley. So we stayed in the churchyard like a regular courting couple and talked one another's ears off. Afterwards it was dinner on the grounds, and we talked some more. Before that day was over, Mr. Blakesley said he was a-goin' marry me soon as he come back from peddling in the mountains. I remember she laughed about how quick Grandpa could make up his mind. "Maybe he thought I was rich," she added, laughing again. There were those in Cold Sassy who had the same idea. They said the land Mattie Lou's daddy owned was why Ruck Blakesley was so taken with her. She knew they said that, but it never worried her. She always called him Mr. Blakesley, and I never heard him call her anything but Miss Mattie Lou. Once when I was little bitty and Papa and Mama went to Atlanta on the train to buy for the store, I stayed at Grandpa's house and slept on the daybed in the back hall. About daybreak, I heard him stand up to use the pot. The bed creaked as he flopped back down, and I heard him say, "Turn over, Miss Mattie Lou, so I can put my feet up to your stomach. They's cold." At the time, I wondered how Grandpa could get his feet up that high, tall as he was and short as she was. Only when I was older did I think how funny for a man to call his wife Miss Mattie Lou when it was just the two of them in bed. Papa called my mother Miss Tweedy in front of Queenie or neighbors, and Mama in front of me and Mary Toy, but I knew she was Hun or Mary Willis when they were by themselves. Everybody in Cold Sassy admired my grandmother. At her funeral, I heard somebody say, "Miss Mattie Lou just reeked of refinement, didn't she?" And I knew what was meant. Her refinement wasn't like Aunt Carrie's. Granny didn't sit on her porch reading Greek and Latin and Shakespeare or get up lectures for children or recite poetry. She didn't think she always knew best the way Aunt Carrie did and didn't throw off on people who said, "I seen" or "I taken" like Aunt Loma, and didn't make children practice manners like Mama. But Granny was a fine lady anyway, never mind her grammar or her country ways, and never mind how plain she was. To my thinking, it was refined that she didn't fuss at Grandpa about not having the house wired for electricity. When Mr. Sheffield, the mill owner, bought a Delco generator for the mill and contracted with the town to install 20 streetlights and run wires to all the houses and stores on both sides of the railroad tracks, practically everybody got electricity except Grandpa and the mill workers and the colored folks in Pigfoot Bottoms. But you didn't hear Granny complain about having to trim wicks, clean smoked-up lamp chimneys, and fool with kerosene when other ladies could just pull a ceiling cord to get light. Grandpa wouldn't pay to hook into the new water main and sewer system either. Said he didn't mind going to Egypt, which was what everybody in town called privies. He never seemed to notice that Granny was still drawing well water and emptying slop jars after other women were turning faucets and pulling tank chains. Still and all, Grandpa loved Granny. Nobody would doubt it if they'd been down there with him and her like I was after she had her stroke. She got took one night early in June. I remember I was at a magic show in the brush arbor, and they called me out. The family sat around Granny's bed till nearly daybreak. She moaned a lot and hiccuped, but never spoke a word. Not even to Grandpa. We went home for breakfast, and I remember how Papa kept patting Mama's hand. "Please, God, don't take her," she prayed between bites. We could hear Queenie moaning in the kitchen as she fried salt mackerel, her tears splattering in the hot grease. Then she went to singing a Nigerian grief song learned from her daddy, who was lured onto an illegal slave ship in 1848 when he was only 12. The slavers brought him to an island off the Georgia coast and hid him there till he got bought for Mr. Bubba Tate. That's how he ended up in Cold Sassy. Queenie always sang her daddy's African words, but you knew by the wailing and moaning that they meant death. "Don't you dare sing that," Mama yelled from the breakfast room. Soon as we could, Papa and I hurried to the store. We knew Grandpa wouldn't get down there that day. We were so busy we none of us went home to dinner, not even Miss Love, who put aside her hats to help wait on customers. All we had was crackers out of the barrel and rat cheese off the wheel. Dr. Slaughter came by the store from the sickbed about 1 o'clock. He told me Granny was tolerable. But when he went over to the cash register where Papa was, he said, "Hoyt, she's dying, and she can't stop hiccuping. It's wearing her out." You have to understand that Dr. Slaughter was a fine physician. He had not only read medicine for 6 months under a doctor over in Athens, he'd gone 2 whole years to medical school up north. So if he thought Granny was dying, I never doubted it was going to happen. "God's mercy is our only hope," he said as he went out. I went back to the storeroom and knelt down on a sack of cow feed and prayed harder than I ever had before in my life. "O Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on Granny Blakesley," I begged. "Please, God, spare her. If thou wilt just let her live, I promise I'll be a better boy. Please, God, please." Chapter 6. It was all over town about Granny's stroke. Several ladies who went down to the house came by the store later and told us how she was, but at 3 o'clock we still hadn't had any direct word from Grandpa or Mama or Aunt Loma. Papa said he sure did wish Mr. Blakesley had a telephone at home. Finally, Miss Love said, "Mr. Hoyt, why don't you send Will up there?" So Papa said, "Will, run and see how your granny is and how Mama's holding up, and ask Mr. Blakesley if that case of Castoria ever came in from Athens. Chap Cheney's wife needs some for the baby." Aunt Loma was at the door to greet people. When she saw it was only me, she turned away without speaking. Her eyes were swollen, and she held a handkerchief to her mouth. As I went in, Mrs. Means came out with her baby, who had not only spit up but had soiled his diaper, I could tell. The front hall and parlor were full of neighbor ladies, but instead of it being a gaggle of sound like a church meeting's, the talk was all whispered. My mother hurried toward me. I was fixing to ask her about Granny, but her face told me. "Pa won't let anybody in the sick room," she whispered. "Not even me and Loma." Tears welled up in her eyes. "But he'll want to see you, Will." "Is she still hiccuping?" I whispered back. "No, it finally stopped, thank the Lord." Granny was propped up on pillows in the big high-back walnut bed. Her eyes were closed. Her face looked gray. I thought she was dead, but when I stared hard at her chest, I saw a faint rise and fall. Not knowing what to say or do, I tiptoed in and just stood at the foot of the bed, one barefoot on top of the other, and looked at her and Grandpa. He hadn't seen me come in. Sitting in a cane-back rocker pulled up by the bed, he was resting his left elbow near Granny's head. The empty knotted sleeve lay crumpled against her gray hair, and he held her small right hand in his big bony one. He was staring at Granny like she could hold on to life if only he didn't blink. But all of a sudden, Grandpa's chest started jerking in the strangest way, and his eyes squeezed shut. Between the heavy mustache and the bushy white-streaked beard, his mouth stretched across his teeth in a fierce smile. Then his lips squeezed shut. Though he made no sound, his chest kept jerking. I didn't know what to think. It scared me. But then he gasped, and tears ran down his cheeks as he buried his face in his hand. I had never in my life seen a grown man cry that way. Preachers and sinners cried at revivals, and old Chickenfoot Creasy, a colored man, would cry when he came to our back door begging victuals for his children on a cold winter day, but not silent like this. Grandpa would have hated being seen. I sneaked out of the room, went out on the back porch, and stood watching Granny's white leghorn rooster chase the Dominica hens and the Rhode Island Reds. Then I went in the kitchen where several ladies were talking. The table was just full of good things folks had brought in, and I ate some fried chicken and a piece of lemon meringue pie. When I peeped into the sick room again, Grandpa was bent forward in the rocker, his arms and head resting on the bed by Granny's side. Her eyes were still closed, but her right hand brushed across his mane of dark hair.
"You need your hair cut, Mr. Blakesley."
Her words came weak and slurred. The left side of her mouth drooped like a rosebud gone too long without water.
"Soon as I get better, I'm going to cut it and trim your beard."
At which Grandpa got up quickly and stood a spell before the window, getting a hold of himself. After he sat back down in the rocker, he gently pushed the hair off Granny's damp forehead, then blew his nose loudly, like a foghorn tell the truth, and said, I seem to have caught a little cold, Miss Mattie Lou. That's when he saw me standing in the doorway.
Grandpa, I said, why don't you go get you some lemon meringue pie? I'll sit with Granny.
He started to argue, but Granny smiled a tiny one-sided smile and said,
Look, Willie, I ain't hardly seen my Willie.
Soon as he tiptoed out, she closed her eyes. I think she slept. In a few minutes, Grandpa was back with a dark red rose in his hand, biting off the thorns and spitting them out as he walked toward the bed. When Granny roused a little, he held the rose close to her face. His hand was trembling. He said gruffly, Here. She tried to take the blossom, but it fell to the sheet. Picking it up, he sat staring at it